From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour is being made in state legislatures across the country, where conversations about gun rights and gun legislation have gained urgency this week, following the mass shooting of children in Texas. That's just one of the many issues that we will discuss this hour with Assemblymember Jen Lunsford. It's part of our ongoing series of conversations with local state lawmakers about the news of the day and the recently passed state budget. And we discuss a wide range of issues when we have these opportunities, but you can understand why some of these issues have risen to the top. And frankly, we scheduled this conversation before the overturning of Roe v. Wade was likely. And now, of course, we have two mass shootings in a month. And I mean, it's tough. But Assemblymember Jen Lunsford, you didn't get into politics because it was easy. Nobody does. Ed Rath was on the program. Same thing with him. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Happy to be here.
So I'm going to start with gun legislation. And there's some things probably happening in the coming days. We've heard Governor Hochul talking about the urgency here. But I'm not sure there are easily accessible, simple policy solutions, although I'd love for you to kind of set the stage on what's out there, what's being discussed, and where you see it.
Sure. So when we talk about gun violence prevention, that is, of course, a holistic view of what the causes of gun violence are, what is making people not just commit the kind of gun violence we see day to day, but these insane, inhumane domestic terror incidents. And I think that there are lots of things we can do legislatively around guns, and you're going to see a package come forward this week. What exactly we're passing is still being negotiated, but I think we're going to do some stuff around expanding the extreme risk protection orders to plug some of the holes that we discovered involving the Buffalo shooter. We're going to deal with access to body armor, which I think is something most people can agree the average person does not need to have access to. But then, you know, things start to get complicated when we talk about mental health, because mental health issues do not make someone innately violent. Of course, a mass murderer has a mental health issue. Everybody can agree with that. But most people with mental health issues are not more violent than other people. And you can't deny an entire class of people a civil right because of a medical diagnosis. And there's also then the practical ramification of if you start tying mental health treatment to access to guns, it will make people stop seeking treatment because they fear having their rights taken away. So I think we have to be very cautious and careful when dealing with those issues, but it's clearly something we have to deal with.
So let's talk about a couple of the specific components. Let me start with body armor. I think it's been reported in different ways what happened in Texas. I think the initial report was full body armor. I think the subsequent reports indicate some kind of body armor, but maybe not necessarily the full body armor that the Buffalo shooter had. Regardless, when you say access to body armor, what do you mean? Are we talking Kevlar? Are we talking other materials? And how do you regulate that?
So right now, we conferenced this last week in a very general way. And of course, throughout the 107-person majority, there are many different bills. So I don't know what we're actually going to see or how it's going to be regulated until next week when they present us with the bills. But I think when we're talking about what the Buffalo shooter had access to, which was militarized tactical gear that made it such that police could not appropriately engage him. That's a problem. And we can't have everyday citizens accessing protections that make it hard for law enforcement to control them. However, we also want to make sure that we don't craft our law in a way that limits law enforcement or private security's access to necessary protections as well. And I think that was part of what made us not settle on something last week. We wanted to make sure that we weren't throwing the baby out with the bathwater with regard to that statute.
Okay, so there will be something on body armor. We'll see more specifics next week. You're confident that there is something that is wise and fair in reach here?
I hope so. I think that we can come to a compromise that keeps people safer without infringing on civil rights, and that, you know, 80%, sometimes 90%, depending on what you're talking about, people agree that the average citizen should not have access to any kind of weaponry they want. That's a pretty standard mainstream belief.
So a couple of points on where there's a lot of agreement then. Nick Kristof in the New York Times had a piece yesterday saying that there are proposals that he believes are in that category of mostly common ground that could save 15,000 lives a year. One of the points that he makes that I think is true is that sometimes you hear a proposal, whether it's and I'm not saying this is your proposal, I'm talking generally. Let's say it's ban AR-15s. Those who oppose that will say, well, people will still be able to get them. They'll find a way to get them. Christoph's point is when we start talking about specific kinds of proposals, there are some people who will circumvent them, but the research and the data indicates that a significant number will not. And if we're talking about saving 15,000 lives a year because of these, then we should do what he says, look at Wyoming. Wyoming is one of the most sort of gun rights forward states in the country, and yet you got to be 21. Can't be 18. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, and actually that's something that we're looking at here in New York. I know that there was a case in California where a increase of the age to purchase certain weapons was struck down, so we're trying to figure out the law around that. But I think that that's exactly true, that this bad faith argument that if you can't fix everything, then fix nothing, hasn't worked. We've tried nothing. I'm looking around us and I'm seeing decades of us trying nothing and it doesn't appear to be working. 109 people die a day in our country from gun violence. And that's, we're talking right now about criminal gun violence. We're not talking about the people who die of suicides, the enormous number of veterans who die of suicides, how a gun turns a bad day into a suicide, particularly for men over 55, the numbers of toddlers who die. Like, that's not even, we're not even getting to that very complex issue. This is just about preventing criminal gun violence.
And Christoph points out there are regulations about ladder safety, and there's ladder safety outreach because 100 people die from falling off ladders in this country a year, and there is less kind of outreach on firearms, especially when it comes to licensing. Now, how do we feel about licensing for firearms?
So I will say, whenever someone talks to me about how we regulate this or that, I remind them that we don't have a constitutional right to ladders. And that always complicates the issue. It always makes it harder to regulate things when we're trying to balance a constitutional right to access to that thing. And it would take a much broader show to talk about what the Second Amendment is and what it means and the jurisprudence around that. But that is a complicating factor. There's a lot of interesting licensing issues, and you should have actually County Clerk Jamie Romeo on here sometime to talk about bills of sale and permitting. There's some just wacky stuff that we do in this state around permitting. We don't have a electronic system for checking whether your gun permit was yanked in another county. So let's say you had your gun permit taken away in Monroe and you move to Yates and you apply again. The way the judge knows that you didn't have it withdrawn is that you check the box that it didn't on your application.
That's it.
It's a real bummer.
So is there going to be a proposal to change that?
We really should. It's a whole thing.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So this is the kind of thing that I think most people would agree on. This isn't confiscation. Although, you know, the question of AR-15s, I saw one listener to the show yesterday. We were talking to parents about, you know, irrational and rational fear yesterday. And one parent wrote in and said, if we're a deep blue state, if we can't ban AR-15s, if we can't ban certain weapons, then no one will. What do you think about that?
I think that when you start talking about banning things, particularly on a state-by-state level, you're missing the point, because the vast majority of guns that are used in mass shootings, which for the most part are gang shootings, we always talk about mass shootings as these individualized terror events, but if you look at the stats, a mass shooting is a shooting of more than four people. Most of those are gang shootings, and most of those guns are illegal, and they came in from out of state. So unless the federal government's going to step up and deal with this on a broader issue, we're never going to address the iron pipeline that brings these guns into our state from other places.
You mentioned also some of I think some of your initial remarks were, since Buffalo, some of the possible cracks that could be filled in regarding, what was it?
ERPO, the Extreme Risk Protection Orders,
okay,
which
yes.
Some people know as the red flag laws.
Red flag.
We like to use a variety of terms to confuse people, of course. but one of the complications, and we're still trying to understand what happened with the Buffalo shooter, was that this is a person who did receive a mental health evaluation for a threat against a school and somehow was not flagged in our system. And our system doesn't really check for mental health issues for a variety of the reasons I've already discussed. We are looking at a proposal. Again, I don't know what's going to shake out next week, but we're looking at a proposal to expand who can apply for an extreme risk protection order. When we originally made those laws, it was really more about victims, domestic violence situations, parents who were concerned about their children, to allow healthcare practitioners to apply for ERPOs if they felt that somebody was a threat. So I haven't seen that bill because we were kind of talking about a variety of things. So I don't have a lot of the details on that, but that's sort of the broad category of ideas we were discussing.
You're an attorney. Your understanding of the law is better than mine and probably most. And I'm curious to know just generally, you know, you brought up the Second Amendment and you're right, that's a whole show. The question I have is, do you think we could have a good faith conversation with people on different sides of this? I ask that because I genuinely don't know what the founders would think if they understood that firearms were not set up in a way that it takes about 90 seconds per shot, that you could do the kind of damage that if they saw the length of the bullets and what it can do to the human body, I don't know what they would think. I'm not sitting here saying I know for sure that every founder would agree on one way or another. I do suspect that some might say, we didn't mean that. But I don't know if we can even talk about that anymore. Do you think we can?
So I think you can talk about that with normal people.
What does that mean?
Your average person, your average gun owner, your average citizen. I think the gun issue is so challenging because there's two types of people in the world. There are people who feel safer around a gun, and there's people who feel less safe around a gun. And it's very hard emotionally to deal with those two kinds of people for whom a gun on the table makes them viscerally feel a different emotion. But if you're talking to someone who doesn't have ulterior political motives or monetary motives, if you look at the NRA before Wayne LaPierre, they were a sportsman's group who was one of the foremost advocates for gun safety because they cared that people took guns seriously and treated them like weapons and not toys. And they would be the first person out talking about safe gun regulation. I have heard from people in the military. I have heard from police officers. I heard a police chief, and I cannot remember who this was, of a major city say no citizen should have an AR-15 because they had AR-15s. Now, would our founding fathers say the government shouldn't have more powerful weapons than the citizenry? I don't know. There's a little bit about guns in the Federalist and Anti-Federalist Papers, and you are talking to a particular nerd who owns the Federalist and Anti-Federalist Papers and reviews them from time to time. So it's hard to say what that would be, but I think certainly the Second Amendment as contemplated didn't understand what technology would do.
Yeah.
And does not entitle you to weapons of war. There's a common misconception about the Second Amendment that it cannot be fettered in any way. We fetter all of our civil rights. You can't yell fire in a movie theater. You can't lie in advertising. The police can violate your Fourth Amendment right in the case of an emergency. We can put time, place, and manner restrictions on protest. The Second Amendment isn't some special flower that can't be limited in any way. Other civil rights get limited. But there are the realities that it is interpreted per D.C. v. Heller to apply to personal home weapons, and we have to deal with that jurisprudence as it exists.
Okay. We're going to move on to other subjects, but let me grab a phone call on this subject. This is Ingrid in Penfield. Hi, Ingrid. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks so much. I'm glad to hear that something may eventually be done. High time, and let's see if it happens. I appreciate the conversation. Wanted to say one thing originally and then another thing since Evan asked. No, you will not be able to have a good faith conversation about this on your show. And I wish that you would stop trying. We do not need everyone to agree in order for there to be effective legislation. I am 100% positive that you could find easily, without looking too hard, people who still don't want to wear their seatbelts. Did seatbelts save lives? Yes, they did. This is not really as hard as you want to make it. And a lot of other people want to make it. I think yours is a sincere and good faith question, but for many people, they'll be thrilled that you want to keep trying to make everybody happy. It's not always kumbaya, Evan. Jen Lunsford, I want to say that not everyone does agree with you that anyone who goes into a supermarket and shoots blacks has a mental illness. Racism is not a mental illness unless at some future time they decide to put it in the DSM as a mental illness. At this point, it's hate and right-wing radicalization. I think you should be very careful and leave the mental illness diagnoses to professionals. Otherwise, the entire jurisdiction, that's not what I mean, the judicial system will fall to the ground because it's really important when someone is being tried for a crime, whether they're truly mentally ill or not. And so there are plenty of us who wish that the discussion which is being pushed hard by NRA supporters in the direction of mental illness, would not be taken there by people who I hope would know better. Thanks. That's what I wanted to say.
Ingrid, thank you for the phone call. Jen Lunsford.
Ingrid, you're exactly right. And I thank you for reminding us to every single time we talk about Buffalo, I was talking about broadly about mass shootings in general. But when we talk about Buffalo in particular, to make sure that we identify that as domestic terror, as racism and white supremacy at all times, and to make sure that people understand that that is the radicalization of young men that is happening all across our country. If you look even here in Rochester at gun violence in our own community, look at the ages of the people involved, 21, 18, 17, 16. It's our young men, and they are being radicalized, and that's a very real thing. I was more broadly referring to the idea that people who commit murder probably have some kind of mental health issue, but not at all to suggest that mental health excuses or invalidates the very real hate that drove the Buffalo shooting.
Yeah, and I'm not positive that mental health experts think that that is an obvious case of mental illness, though if you are going into a classroom and shooting children, I have to think something is deeply broken, but I'm not the expert here.
And unfortunately, the standard, or fortunately, for insanity in a court system is virtually impossible to meet.
Yeah.
And I don't think that the Buffalo shooter or the person in qualify in a legal setting for an insanity plea. They knew what they were doing.
Assemblymember Jen Lunsford is our guest for the hour, serving District 135 and talking about state issues. And I want to turn, I was going to say briefly, I mean, like, let's just talk a little bit about what has happened in the last decade to codify Roe v. Wade in this. Oh, go ahead.
I just had a thought about a provision that we are looking at, and I want to address that issue. My colleague Pat Fahey has a bill to create an online extremism task force in the AG's office. And I think that's really essential. And I hope that we do take that bill up, because we do need to address where our children are getting these ideas from. And these, you know, you're hearing about online gaming forums, you're hearing about online social media platforms. We need to address where this information is coming from.
But how do you regulate it?
It's a task force. So you kind of have to watch it. And I don't know that you can stop it. I don't know that you can regulate it, but you can watch it and try to track the people who are saying, as some of these criminals did, I'm going to go shoot up an elementary school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sometimes they're very explicit in these forums. Yeah. So we've talked about Roe on this program before, and New York State in the last decade has moved to codify Roe. And so there may be an assumption for people who live in the state that, well, no matter what happens next month at the Supreme Court, status quo here, that it is sort of fortified and protected. How do you see it?
I'm very grateful to the legislative body that came before me when I joined the legislature, that they did pass the Reproductive Health Act that codifies Roe v. Wade in New York, so that no matter what happens at the Supreme Court level this week, abortion will be protected here. However, there are still lots of barriers to access in New York, even with our laws. I know people that have had to travel to Colorado for procedures that we couldn't do here. And there's going to be an influx of people coming to our state who are seeking refuge from the limitations in their states, and we have to be prepared to receive them. We're looking at taking up some more legislation this year about insulating people from the liability and ramifications from the states they're coming from, to ensure that the rights that all women are entitled to and all pregnant people are entitled to are safe here in New York.
And let's talk a little bit more then about some of the deeper issues. If you actually read the text of what was released from the Supreme Court, all of the reporting so far from some very experienced Supreme Court reporters indicates that there has not been any real change in where the justices are. In other words, the likelihood is that what we saw leaked, which is an authentic document, and the majority opinion authored by Justice Alito, is going to hold. Could change, but the indication is we ought to be prepared next month for that to hold, and that will be the law of the land. And your reading on that kind of goes beyond just sort of immediately Roe. Tell me about that.
So the particular theory that the court used in the draft document that we saw goes beyond simply overturning Roe v. Wade and Casey. It attacks the idea that we don't have penumbral rights in the Constitution, which means rights that are implied around the stated rights. And that is a legitimate legal theory. But when you talk about the Ninth Amendment, which is where we find the right to privacy, the ramifications of that are very broad. It's not just about abortion. One of the first times we saw that was in a case called Stanley v. Georgia, and it dealt with watching pornography in your own home. That's kind of how those rights started to come forth. And you see them in cases about birth control, but privacy extends further than that into banking and consumer privacy, into online and cybersecurity. There are ramifications for saying that we don't have a fundamental right to privacy in this country, and I'm very concerned about what could come out of the Supreme Court if this is the foundation we're moving forward on.
What is the most realistic threat, as you see? I mean, how realistic do you see this?
Very, very realistic.
You really do.
I think we are looking at either birth control or gay marriage going next.
Okay, so...
And I want to point out that this is the first time the Supreme Court has ever rolled back a right. We have never earned a right and had the Supreme Court taken it away until now. And this Supreme Court has demonstrated a willingness to unravel what all of them stated was super stare decisis, was super precedent, something that has been upheld 43 or more times in their own court over the years. Their willingness to unravel that, they'll take out things we just did, no problem.
When it comes to equal marriage, that's something we talked about on this program earlier this month, and that's pretty clear. If you read Justice Alito, some of the language that he uses in this forthcoming decision and some of what he has already said about Obergefell is clear that he thinks that was poorly decided. Obergefell is the case that Justice Anthony Kennedy was the swing vote deciding that equal marriage should be the law of the land. He objected strongly to Obergefell. He references it here. The indication is that it very well could be similar to Roe, maybe next. And if that happens, do you see a similar situation where, again, individual states will have their own laws, New York's will be largely status quo, et cetera?
I don't want to jinx anything, and I fear saying something like this out loud. But I don't think this Supreme Court will go as far as making something illegal that is not otherwise illegal, but rather will return those decisions to the state. I hope this sentence does not come back to haunt me.
Okay. On the subject of contraception, is it such a case that the Supreme Court is not likely to, quote, overturn access to contraception, and instead tinker with who has to provide it, what insurance covers, et cetera?
So I think that birth control is mainstream enough and used widely and accepted by most major religions as a thing that is okay for married people to use. And I think what you will see is states making laws limiting access by minors, limiting access of who can prescribe, about what kinds of birth controls are available and which are not, and I fear will be made by people who don't have medical training, who are making political decisions and not medical decisions. And I think that people who really care about reducing the number of abortions should be as embracing of birth control and a comprehensive sex ed as anybody else, because they want to limit the amount of abortions we have. And as someone else did here, as a mother, as someone who had fertility problems, as someone who fought to get pregnant, as someone who had pregnancy losses, not every pregnancy, even in the best of times, is going to be a healthy one. And you will never eliminate all abortion. It's impossible. It is medically impossible.
On the subject of comprehensive sex ed, that's our conversation next hour. And that was sparked in part because earlier this week, we welcomed some of the recent winners in school board elections, some of the newly elected school board members across our community. And one of them was a school board member in Greece who says that he objects. His words were that he objects to what Senator Summer Brouk has proposed regarding comprehensive sex ed. He didn't appreciate the notion of teaching sexual pleasure to very young children. And again, I pressed him for specifics. And he said that he's only really responding to what he's heard in reports, which unfortunately is what we often hear in this. I mean, we should aim to be very specific about what we're talking about, because often it veers into sort of cable news shouting matches about things that aren't really real. But next hour, we're going to try to delve into what the research says is effective and what the real proposals are. Now, speaking of the real proposals here, let's talk about what is happening here and what you support.
So I think that this has been politicized and wildly misunderstood by people who seek to use this bill to cause chaos. The Comprehensive Sex Ed Bill just wants people to have appropriate education about body health. And I think sex ed is a loaded term. And I think that we have a problem with I wish we called it something else. Call it healthy relationships or body awareness. I'm the mother of a kindergartner in a public school. And I can tell you that the kindergarten curriculum contemplated by that bill is like not biting each other and keeping your pants on and ensuring that
literally not exposing your genitals.
Yeah,
to
I mean,
people.
Anyone who has a small boy maybe has that conversation a couple times a day about where it is OK to take our pants on and off. Keeping our hands to ourselves, teaching little kids about consent, that if your friend doesn't want a hug, don't give them a hug. We're not teaching the mechanics of sex or of STDs or how to use condoms to kindergartners, but the broader discussion around healthy relationships and what our bodies are for and not for begins before school. And I think that we need to begin to have those conversations in a way that we know is scientifically accurate and age appropriate. And that's all that bill does.
Just reading some of what the New York Post has reported, the Post raised a kind of objection saying that this bill would, quote, teach anal sex to fifth graders.
I don't think that that is an accurate representation of what this bill does. And I think that that's dangerous and counterproductive. And I wish people would engage seriously on this issue. When we look at violence in all realms, we talk about gun violence. But let's talk about the fact that the average woman is going to have a friend by the time she's 18 who's been raped. And if you want to talk about reducing a child's potential for being exploited by somebody, this teaches that. This teaches kids about stranger danger. It teaches them what's good and bad. It teaches them that there are safe adults in their life who can shield them from people who mean them harm. And the same people who are saying that this bill is going to in some way harm our children are the ones talking to me about Pizzagate. You really want to keep kids safe from child predators, you got to teach them that their bodies are their own and their bodies are sacred and their bodies are theirs to decide what to do with.
I think underlying some of the criticism, and I'm only basing it based on the interaction with some listeners of this program and some what I've been trying to read. I think underlying this is a little bit of resistance to teaching kids gender identity and identity issues that you're in my generation, certainly our parents and grandparents, that was not on the radar at all.
I think you saw this a little bit in Pittsburgh, where some elementary schools wanted to put together a rainbow club, which was just the kind of an LGBTQIA awareness club for kids who were maybe had parents who were gay or who themselves were having questions about their gender identity. And the pushback was absolutely insane. The pushback against that, again, as if you were going to show children pornography instead of reading them books where the characters had parents, like one of the kids had two dads. This idea that there is some fundamental right to prevent children from understanding that people exist is a major problem in our society.
I think it even goes beyond two dads. I think there's a resistance to gender fluidity and the teaching of it. What would you say to people who do object to that, to teaching about gender identity to elementary school kids?
I think that when we talk about school shootings, when we talk about sexual assault, we are talking about toxic masculinity. And it's not even as much about fluidity, because the transgender population is a very, very small part of our population. But the idea that being a man or being a woman means a thing is very prevalent, and that it's okay for little boys to cry and for little girls to like sports is a gender issue in many ways. And the more we talk about those ideas and the idea that gender is not rigid and gender identity and expression are not rigid, we will help solve some of these broader societal problems.
Okay. We're going to take our only break, and we're going to come back. And by the way, much more on some of those subjects next hour. But we're going to come back and talk about some other issues regarding state business with Assemblymember Jen Lunsford, who is our guest for the hour. And we'll take your emails if you want to send them, connections@wxxi.org. We are right back. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about new curriculum proposals for sex education here and across the country. Earlier this week, a newly elected board member from the Greece School Board of Education told us that he objected to these kinds of proposals, but it turns out that a lot of the objections are not really based on reality. What are the proposals? And what does research say about what kids benefit from? We'll talk about it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So let's talk about some of the other issues that are prevalent for New York State right now. And listeners, if you want, and you still feel like you need some explanation on some of the issues we've already discussed, whether it's possible gun legislation, abortion rights, reproductive health, et cetera, you can weigh in with that. But there's a lot of other things going on. And one of the things that's sort of top of mind for you is the Department of Veteran Affairs. What's going on?
Oh, we did a really exciting thing. I get to talk about a good thing. I'm like, yay. Everything's always awful. I did a good thing. We previously had a division of Veterans Affairs under the Division of Human Services. And what that did was greatly limit the way you can serve veterans in our state. One of the frustrating parts of my job is money's very siloed in the state. If you aren't receiving a service that is under DOH, I can't give you DOH money. And veterans issues obviously run a gamut from housing insecurity, food insecurity, workforce issues, substance abuse issues, mental health issues. And those things are horizontal, whereas the funding for them is vertical. This year in our budget, we elevated the Division of Veteran Services to a department, which gives it its own commissioner and would then allow for a line of funding to serve veterans issues as a whole. Instead of having to pick and choose across all these different agencies, we could house all veterans issues in one place so the funding goes direct to those people and organizations. I have a veteran service organization in my district, CDS, who does a lot of comprehensive veteran services. And I struggle sometimes even to give them grant money because the money's coming from the wrong direction. So I was very excited that we were able to accomplish that in this year's budget.
So let me connect something to that, which may seem a little far afield, but this has been on my mind lately. I'm always naive about what I think is going to bring this country together, right? I mean, like the pandemic happened, I'm like, oh, this will be unifying. Like people are going to have to go through something and then we're going to work hard together. We're going to lift each other up. I'm so naive. But watching the invasion of Ukraine and watching how fragile the earned freedoms, rights, and even sort of imperfect fledgling democracies like Ukraine, watching how fragile that can be and how ruthless those who oppose democracy can be, I thought this is something. As Francis Fukuyama said, that we're going to have a spirit of 1989 movement around the world here. It's going to galvanize the West. It's going to galvanize democracies, and there will be an appreciation anew for a number of things. Number one, kind of coming together and supporting freedom, forget differences, support freedom, and a renewed appreciation for those who really did put their lives on the line. Because the longer we go as a society, and I understand we are at war right now. And we've been at war. There's not been a time where we haven't been at war. But I'm talking about the way that a lot of Americans think about war. Are we even at war? Do we know people serving? And when you think about veteran services, I was thinking this is going to have a whole new appreciation across political ideologies, backgrounds, et cetera, because of just how fragile freedom truly actually is, it turns out, and what it means to be willing to die to protect it. And I'm curious to know not only how you feel about that, but how you think we are doing in supporting veterans in this state.
So to take the first issue, I think what's interesting about Ukraine is it's not even so much the general idea that Ukraine could be subject to this kind of invasion. It's the real-time social media and videos from the ground that make it impossible for us to deny the reality of war. And I don't think we've ever really seen that about what it looks like when you bomb a maternity ward, about parents identifying their children in the street by the color of their shoes. That's a thing now we see and we are unaccepting of. That's always been happening in war, but now it's in our face on CNN 24/7. And I think that's changing people's idea of their willingness to engage in war. And I hope that we can carry that forward. And I think support for Ukraine has been a really bipartisan issue. I'll tell you that I have seen houses in my neighborhood that had flags associated with more conservative ideas, swap those flags out for Ukrainian flags in recent weeks. So I hope that that is something that we can kind of get together on. But for the most part, it's not, I think, that we don't appreciate what veterans do. I think that veterans are invisible in a lot of ways, and that we as a state and as a country do not step up for our veterans the way we need to. We take young men and women, and we send them to far-flung places to do very challenging things, and they come back a little bit broken sometimes, and they come back with out some coping skills that they maybe should have been better prepared for. And we need to do a better job of supporting them when they're here to take some of the really great workforce skills that they develop while in the military and help link them to jobs here, to give them the mental health support they need to reintegrate with society. Because coming out of a military environment, even just where your meals are prepared for you and your time is not your own, that's an adjustment to civilian life. Never mind the people who actually suffered real trauma and who saw really terrible things that we need to deal with. So I think it's inherent in our duty as an American to support the people who sacrifice for us in all ways. And we do fall down on that when we deal with veterans.
Number of other issues, and we're just going to kind of go all across the board here in a lot of different directions. Going down the list here, $600 million for a new Buffalo Bills stadium. How's that sit with you?
So this is a complex issue, because I do want to point out that what we actually did in the budget was a $1.82 million bond. That's what passed in the budget. A bond is issuance to the taxpayers. It's a loan from the taxpayers. And the rest of that stadium, as was presented to us in the newspaper, I will add, not in any other way, we found out when everybody else found out, and that was maybe not the best situation for us.
As in communication from the governor's office?
Correct. That deal was made without our involvement and was given to the legislature to say yes or no to.
So you think that's a failure of the governor in this case?
It was not the best negotiating tactic, and I think is part of why the budget was late, because we had to deal with that and some other issues in the media for the first time.
Why do you think the governor did that, by the way?
I don't know. And I'm not going to speculate on what her motivations were.
Okay.
But
okay. I get you.
I've otherwise had a really good relationship with the governor. That was a real problem for everybody. But the stadium is being funded by a bond and also by revenue sharing that rightly belongs to Western New York anyway, as part of the revenue sharing agreement with the Seneca. And we can talk separately about whether that's an appropriate use of funds. But I think there's been a misconception that by providing funding to the stadium, you're somehow taking away from another program. And it's important to talk about the difference between capital and programmatic funding. In the budget, we have buckets. We have capital money that's always going to be capital money. And we have programmatic money that's always going to be programmatic money. So you don't take money from Medicaid and build a stadium with it. That's just not the way our money flows. The capital money, you could say, would have gone to better use in other infrastructure projects in Buffalo. And that's fair. But when we talk about stadiums, people always focus on the economic revenue generated. You don't see your return on investment. When you're dealing with Buffalo, we need to talk about the loss. What would happen if the Bills left? Because that's the thing. If you don't build them the stadium, I guarantee you, Nashville will. Austin will. Other places will build them a stadium, because every stadium in this state, in this country, has been either funded with public dollars, or the infrastructure around the stadium was funded with public dollars. Yankee Stadium, if you count the infrastructure that went into building Yankee Stadium, got more than the Bills did. And when you're looking at a city like New York City that has two of every sports team, it's very easy to stand there and say, oh, I don't like what's going on in Buffalo. If you took the Bills out of Buffalo, that is a $27 million loss immediately just in sales tax and income tax from the players. It would carve a heart out of Orchard Park. It would just leave a hole there. And they would lose all the revenue that comes from people from Toronto, from Boston, from Pittsburgh, coming to see their teams in Buffalo because it's cheaper to see them here than in their home stadiums. Never mind the psychic gash it would leave in Western New York.
It's a pretty full-throated defense of keeping the bills here, making an investment?
I had to really think about this, and I had to really come to terms with where I was on it. And I know that this is maybe not the most popular opinion, but the loss of the Bills to Buffalo would have been substantially worse than the otherwise, frankly, relatively modest investment we made in it, when you consider the fact that the year before, we gave $2 billion to build a freaking skyscraper above Penn Station. People don't understand how much money goes into economic development in terms of building buildings in this state. And you can say that's gross and we shouldn't do it, but make that argument on New York City's time.
Okay, so that's where we are with the Bills. And, you know, one of the things we hear from the opponents of that is, how can you spend that and still have a homelessness crisis, et cetera, or a housing crisis? And I want to touch on something where two of your Democratic colleagues at the state level have disagreed on this program recently. State Senator Jeremy Cooney does not support good cause eviction as it's currently written legislation at the state level. Assembly member Sarah Clark does. And the debate is it effective? Will it be helpful? Versus, will it have unintended consequences? Will it push more local landlords and property owners to sell to out-of-state corporations? Is it worse or better for people who are vulnerable in that spot? Where are you on this one?
So I don't co-sponsor that bill because I don't think it's perfect. I think that there are things we can do to help enable municipalities who want to make that decision. That right now there's been a good cause eviction has been passed in a number of municipalities.
Albany, a few other places,
yeah,
in the Hudson
Kingston.
Valley. Yeah, right.
And there are lawsuits right now saying that those were not constitutional, that the state needs to take action. And I know that the city of Rochester chose not to move forward because they believed the state needed to take action. I think I'm supportive of enabling legislation to allow municipalities to make those decisions. But also, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I know this is a controversial bill, but not in my district. I did a constituent survey on it, and most people support it. But keep in mind, my district's got about 12% renters. But the renters in my district are disproportionately older. They are 55 and older in retirement communities or otherwise. And I have little old ladies in my district who had their rent jacked up 10%. And I'll tell you that every complaint I've gotten in my district about rents being increased has been from one corporate landlord who owns many, many properties. And I think that's a problem. And we need to figure out a way to address that. And if you really dig into good cause, you're hard-pressed to find a scenario where a landlord would not be allowed to evict for a valid reason. They can evict for non-payment of rent, for someone being a nuisance, for someone committing a crime, for somebody otherwise violating another term of the lease. They can't evict because they want to rent that apartment for more money. That's really the only reason. If you just want to kick someone out so that you can rent that apartment for more money, that law prevents that. And I think there's an argument to be made for maybe that's a thing we shouldn't be allowed to do, because people shouldn't be kicked out of their house for capitalism.
But to be clear on where you are, it sounds to me, tell me if I'm wrong here, that as currently written, you don't support the statewide good cause eviction legislation. You would support a proposal that essentially legislates the capacity to do this to municipalities, to take that question off the table, to let them decide.
I'm still reviewing this, and I'm okay. Not willing to say that I don't support it. But I have been in a lot of conversations about where this should go and whether it's something we should take up this year. And I know that it has been a conversation that we've had, but I don't know that a decision's been made. The world events have eaten our end of year agenda, but something needs to be done to protect renters because people are drowning in rent increases because of inflation.
Okay. It does sound like, though, that you would be okay with getting more of a green light for municipalities in the meantime.
Absolutely.
Okay. On this program yesterday, the director of environmental services from Monroe County said that in a very good-natured way, well, everything Mike Garland said is good-natured. He's a nice guy. He said, you should ask members of the assembly, like Assemblymember Lunsford, where we are on the bottle bill, because a lot of listeners, we talk recycling, say, what are you doing with my wine bottles? Like, that should be like the easiest thing to recycle, wine bottles, other glass. And it turns out glass is a lot harder to recycle. and people are sort of shocked about that. Where do you stand on the so-called bottle bill and what's going on with this?
I think everyone basically supports the bottle bill, but it's more complicated. For people who don't know, the bottle bill would increase the redemption rate from 5 cents to 10 cents for the things you can put into the machine at Wegmans. And it would also expand the eligible recyclables. So wine bottles, certain other plastics that we don't otherwise use. There are some municipalities who would lose some revenue because while we don't get redemption for them, they can sell those recyclables. But I think the bigger issue, and I think people are surprised to hear this, is there's right now not much to do with recycled wine bottles. We don't have a good place or a good use of that glass. And the state's invested $25 million. We have people working all over the state, including a leading expert out of Alfred, who are trying to figure out what we can do to recycle wine bottles. So until I think we have a grasp on what we can do with what we're putting into the redemption stream, we need to maybe hold off on that particular expansion. But I am otherwise like super supportive, especially of raising the redemption rate. I think that's great.
We are going to be talking to folks from Alfred University soon on this program about some of the research they're doing about glass recycling. And I know that is something that the Assembly members are excited about, or at least hope we're all hopeful that there are better options forthcoming there. So maybe we're not that far away from being able to do more with glass, but there we are. So we'll talk to Alfred soon about that. By the way, there's also a debate about sort of corporate responsibility and you know, who pays for more recycling, something under the headline of EPR, which is what?
Extended producer responsibility, which is something we've seen with other products. We're kind of taking it on a product-by-product basis. But right now, there's an Engelbreit bill that would deal with placing the cost and impetus for recycling paper and cardboard back onto the manufacturer. You know, when you order something from Amazon and it's the size of your thumb, but for some reason comes in an 8x11 box with a like 6x5 box and then a bunch of paper wrapping inside of it. We don't want that to happen. We need to reduce the amount of paper and cardboard that we use, even though paper is very recyclable. You can recycle a piece of paper about 4.5 times. We need to figure out a way to reduce what we put in our landfills. We talk a lot about recycling, but reducing is the better plan. And we need to start focusing more on reducing our waste rather than recycling our waste.
Okay. And so what's the mechanism legally then or with legislation to do that?
So we did this with paint, where we have a paint stewardship bill. We created a requirement that manufacturers have to take the paint back and recycle it, and we partnered with people. There's a program. So the EPR bill is similar, where it, first off, just has the effect, because it adds a cost, into creating a change in behavior in the people who manufacture the products and the people who choose what to package their items in, which I think the better goal. But similarly, it creates a requirement that the manufacturers figure out how to recycle all of these items, because there are kinds of paper that are not recyclable.
They're going to have to pay more to do it, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's the behavioral impetus to change the behavior that is causing us to have too much waste.
Former Democrat in the county legislature who ran for Sarah Clark's seat, Justin Wilcox, who did not win, who has been, I'm looking for his title, he is now the executive director of Upstate United. He says, New York's economy is recovering from the impacts of the pandemic, and modernizing our recycling infrastructure to generate local investment, jobs, and economic activity is very important. And while seemingly well-intentioned, Assembly Member Engelbreit's bill won't solve the waste crisis as it is currently written.
If we can't fix everything, let's fix nothing. That seems to be where we are on a lot of environmental bills. And unfortunately, our planet's not going to wait for us to be in a convenient economic situation. We need to take the steps we can now to address the problems we can address before it is too late.
Other issues related to clean energy, anything on the horizon that we should know about?
I'm very excited about our move to zero emission school buses. That was a plan put in place by the governor, and I was able to provide some funding to the Penfield School District to start that. I've been in talks with our local school districts about finding ways to siphon kind of member money that, you know, we get kind of discretion on towards these programs because there isn't a fund at the state level, but we're going to be pushing in the off cycle if we want people to adopt zero emission buses, which require a somewhat significant infrastructure investment.
Electrification?
Electrification. Yeah. We need to figure out ways to fund that for our schools because we can't put another unfunded mandate on our schools. But something that we did do was expand how long school districts can lease buses for, which seems silly, but it helps reduce that cost. They used to only be able to lease buses for 5 years. We expanded that to 10.
Last minute, you talked a lot about things that are tough, problems that are sort of doom-filled that the legislature is trying to deal with here. Is there anything that you're working on or your colleagues are working on that feels like it is more hopeful?
We had a really great childcare budget 2 years in a row. You know, between the last 2 years, we've invested more than $5 billion in making childcare more affordable and expanding subsidies.
But it's $5 billion over 3 years, right?
Well, that was between last year and this year. This year, it's $3 billion over 5 years.
$3 billion over 5 years.
Okay. I'm combining 2 years because we had two huge investments. And some of that, it goes direct to wage increases. Some of that is stabilization grants. But the thing that we really did was expand eligibility, that in the coming year, families earning up to 300% of the poverty level will be able to access subsidies to offset 80% of the market rate. So for a family of four, that's $82,000. That's a regular middle-class family that gets a break on the cost of childcare, and that's going to help get parents back into the workforce. That's going to have a huge economic impact. It's super important.
And it will impact people soon, right?
Yes.
Okay. The governor did push the numbers down on this. Is that still an ongoing battle with Albany?
No, that's what we dealt with in this budget, but we're certainly going to keep having that fight year to year until
that's
we get it where
I mean.
It needs to be.
Okay, but in other words, though, it doesn't sound like Assemblymember Lunsford is saying there were no gains here. You do feel
huge
good
gains.
About, huge, okay.
Huge gains.
Which is probably its own conversation.
Yes.
As that rolls out, and we'll do that soon. Thank you. I know every member of the legislature is extremely busy, and when they give us an hour, it is an absolute privilege for listeners and this audience, and we mean that for people of all political backgrounds. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Jen Lunsford, Assemblymember, joining us here. And more connections coming up in a moment.